Naturally enough, her father believed he was still sick. He met a woman he might have married, but didn't because he thought he did not have long to live. He sold his house and moved into a small apartment so he wouldn't have a mortgage. "It sounds like you were waiting to die," the attorney said. "Objection!" "I'll withdraw the question, but let's move on. Mr. Burnett, how long did you continue going to UCLA for testing?"
4 years.
4 years. And when did you first suspect you were not being told the truth about your condition?
Well, 4 years later, I still felt healthy. Nothing had happened. Every day I was waiting for lightning to strike, but it never did. But Dr. Gross kept saying I had to come back for more tests, more tests. By then, I had moved to San Diego, and I wanted to have my test done there and sent up to him. But he said no, I had to do the tests at UCLA.
Why?
He said he preferred his own lab, but it didn't make sense. And he was giving me more and more forms to sign.
What forms?
At first they were just consent forms to acknowledge that I was undertaking a procedure with risk. Those first forms were 1 or 2 pages long. Pretty soon there were other forms that said I agreed to be involved in a research project. Each time I went back, there were still more forms. Eventually, the forms were 10 pages long, a whole document in dense legal language.
And did you sign them?
Toward the end? No.
Why not?
Because some of the forms were releases to permit the commercial use of my tissues.
That bothered you?
Sure, because I didn't think he was telling me the truth about what he was doing. The reason for all the tests. On one visit, I asked Dr. Gross straight out if he was using my tissues for commercial purposes. He said, absolutely not. His interests were purely research. So I said, okay, and I signed everything except the forms allowing my tissues to be used for commercial purposes.
And what happened?
He got very angry. He said he would not be able to treat me further unless I signed all the forms, and I was risking my health and my future. He said I was making a big mistake.
Objection. Hearsay.
All right.
Mr. Burnett, when you refused to sign the consent forms, did Dr. Gross stop treating you?
Yes.
And did you then consult a lawyer?
Yes.
And what did you subsequently discover?
That Dr. Gross had sold my cells,
the cells he took from my body during all these tests, to a drug company called Biogen.
And how did you feel when you heard that?
I was shocked, her father said. I had gone to Dr. Gross when I was sick and scared and vulnerable. I had trusted my doctor. I had put my life in his hands. I trusted him. And then it turned out that he had been lying to me and scaring me needlessly for years, just so he could steal parts of my own body from me and sell them to make a profit for himself. He never cared about me at all. He just wanted to take my cells.
Do you know what those cells were worth?
The drug company said $3 billion. The jury gasped.
Alex had been watching the jury all during the latest testimony. Their faces were impassive, but nobody moved, nobody shifted. The gasps were involuntary, evidence of how deeply engaged they were with what they were hearing, and the jury remained transfixed as the questions continued.
Mr. Burnett, did Dr. Gross ever apologize to you for misleading you?
No.
Did he ever offer to share his profit with you?
No.
Did you ask him to?
Eventually I did, yes, when I realized what he had already done.
They were my cells, from my body.
I thought I should have something to say about what was done with them.
But he refused?
Yes. He said it was none of my business what he did with my cells.
The jury reacted to that. Several turned and looked at Dr. Gross. That was a good sign, too, Alex thought.
One final question, Mr. Burnett. Did you ever sign an authorization for Dr. Gross to use your cells for any commercial purposes?
No.
You never authorized their sale?
Never. But he did it anyway.
No further questions.
The judge called a 15-minute recess, and when the court reconvened, the UCLA attorneys began the cross-examination. For this trial, UCLA had hired Raper and Cross, a downtown firm that specialized in high-stakes corporate litigation. Raper represented oil companies and major defense contractors. Clearly, UCLA did not regard this trial as a defense of medical research. $3 billion were at stake. It was big business, and they hired a big business firm. The lead attorney for UCLA was Albert Rodriguez. He had a youthful, easy appearance, a friendly smile, and a disarming sense of seeming new at the job. Actually, Rodriguez was 45 and had been a successful litigator for 20 years, but he somehow managed to give the impression that this was his first trial, and he subtly appealed to the jury to cut him some slack. "Now, Mr. Burnett, I imagine it has been taxing for you to go over the emotionally draining experiences of the last few years. I appreciate your telling the jury your experiences, and I won't keep you long. I believe you told the jury that you were very frightened, as anyone would naturally be. By the way, how much weight had you lost when you first came to Dr. Gross?" Alex thought, uh-oh. She knew where this was going. They were going to emphasize the dramatic nature of the cure. She glanced at the attorney sitting beside her, who was clearly trying to think of a strategy. She leaned over and whispered, "Stop it!" The attorney shook his head, confused. Her father was saying, "I don't know how much I lost, about 40 or 50 pounds.
"So your clothes didn't fit well?"
"Not at all."
"And what was your energy like at that time? Could you climb a flight of stairs?"
"No. I'd go 2 or 3 steps and I'd have to stop."
"From exhaustion?"
Alex nudged the attorney at her side, whispered, "Asked and answered." The attorney immediately stood up.
"Objection, Your Honor. Mr. Burnett has already stated he was diagnosed with a terminal condition."
"Yes," Rodriguez said. "And he has said he was frightened. But I think the jury should know just how desperate his condition really was."
"I'll allow it."
"Thank you. Now then, Mr. Burnett, you had lost a quarter of your body weight. You were so weak, you couldn't climb more than a couple of stairs, and you had a deadly serious form of leukemia. Is that right?"
"Yes."
Alex gritted her teeth. She wanted desperately to stop this line of questioning, which was clearly prejudicial and irrelevant to the question of whether her father's doctor had acted improperly after curing him. But the judge had decided to allow it to continue, and there was nothing she could do. And it wasn't egregious enough to provide grounds for appeal.
"And for help in your time of need," Rodriguez said, "you came to the best physician on the West Coast to treat this disease?"
"Yes."
"And he treated you?"
"Yes."
"And he cured you. This expert and caring doctor cured you."
"Objection, Your Honor. Dr. Gross is a physician, not a saint."
"Sustained."
"All right," Rodriguez said. "Let me put it this way. Mr. Burnett, how long has it been since you were diagnosed with leukemia?"
6 years."
"Is it not true that a 5-year survival in cancer is considered a cure?"
"Objection. Calls for expert conclusion."
"Sustained."
"Your Honor," Rodriguez said, turning to the judge, "I don't know why this is so difficult for Mr. Burnett's attorneys. I am merely trying to establish that Dr. Gross did, in fact, cure the plaintiff of a deadly cancer."
"And I," the judge replied, "don't know why it is so difficult for the defense to ask that question plainly without objectionable phrasing."
"Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Mr. Burnett, do you consider yourself cured of leukemia?"
"Yes."
"You are completely healthy at this time?"
"Yes."
"Who, in your opinion, cured you?"
Dr. Gross. Thank you. Now, I believe you told the court that when Dr. Gross asked you to return for further testing, you thought that meant you were still ill.
Yes.
Did Dr. Gross ever tell you that you still had leukemia?
No.
Did anyone in his office, or did any of his staff, ever tell you that?
No.
Then, Rodriguez said, if I understand your testimony, at no time did you have any specific information that you were still ill.
Correct.
All right. Now let's turn to your treatment. You received surgery and chemotherapy. Do you know if you were given the standard treatment for T-cell leukemia?
No, my treatment was not standard.
It was new?
Yes.
Were you the first patient to receive this treatment protocol?
Yes, I was.
Dr. Gross told you that?
Yes.
And did he tell you how this new treatment protocol was developed?
He said it was part of a research program.
And you agreed to participate in this research program?
Yes.
Along with other patients with the disease?
I believe there were others, yes.
And the research protocol worked in your case?
Yes.
You were cured?
Yes.
Thank you. Now, Mr. Burnett, you are aware that in medical research, new drugs to help fight disease are often derived from or tested on patient tissues.
Yes.
You knew your tissues would be used in that fashion.
Yes, but not for commercial.
I'm sorry. Just answer yes or no. When you agreed to allow your tissues to be used for research, did you know they might be used to derive or test new drugs?
Yes.
And if a new drug was found, did you expect the drug to be made available to other patients?
Yes.
Did you sign an authorization for that to happen?
A long pause.
Then, yes. Thank you, Mr. Burnett. I have no further questions.
How do you think it went? Her father asked as they left the courthouse. Closing arguments were the following day. They walked toward the parking lot in the hazy sunshine of downtown Los Angeles.
Hard to say, Alex said. They confused the facts very successfully. We know there's no new drug that emerged from this program, but I doubt the jury understands what really happened. We'll bring in more expert witnesses to explain that UCLA just made a cell line from your tissues and used it to manufacture a cytokine, the way it is manufactured naturally inside your body. There's no new drug here, but that'll probably be lost on the jury. And there's also the fact that Rodriguez is explicitly shaping this case to look exactly like the Moore case a couple of decades back. Moore was a case very much like yours. Tissues were taken under false pretenses and sold. UCLA won that one easily, though they shouldn't have.
So, counselor, how does our case stand?
She smiled at her father, threw her arm around his shoulder and kissed him on the cheek. Truth, it's uphill, she said. Barry Sindler, divorce lawyer to the stars, shifted in his chair. He was trying to pay attention to the client seated across the desk from him, but he was having trouble. The client was a nerd named Deal, who ran some biotech company. The guy talked abstractly, no emotion, practically no expression on his face, even though he was telling how his wife was screwing around on him. Deal must have been a terrible husband, but Barry wasn't sure how much money there was in this case. It seemed the wife had all the money. Deal droned on how his first suspicions arose when he called her from Las Vegas, how he discovered the charge slips for the hotel that she went to every Wednesday, how he waited in the lobby and caught her checking in with a local tennis pro. Same old California story. Barry had heard it 100 times. Didn't these people know they were walking clichés? Outraged husband catches wife with a tennis pro. They wouldn't even use that one on Desperate Housewives. Barry gave up trying to listen. He had too much on his mind this morning. He had lost the Kokorovich case, and it was all over town. Just because DNA tests had shown that it wasn't the billionaire's baby, and then the court wouldn't award him his fees, even though he had cut them to a measly 1.4 mil. The judge gave him a quarter of that. Every damn lawyer in town was gloating, because they all had it in for Barry Sindler. He had heard that L.A. Magazine was doing a big story on the case, sure to be unfavorable to Barry. Not that he gave a crap about that. The truth was, the more he got portrayed as an unprincipled, ruthless prick, the more clients flocked to him. Because when it came to a divorce, people wanted a ruthless prick. They lined up for one. And Barry Sindler was, without a doubt, the most ruthless, unscrupulous, publicity-hungry, self-aggrandizing, stop-at-nothing, son-of-a-bitch divorce lawyer in Southern California, and proud of it. No, Barry didn't worry about any of those things. He didn't even worry about the house he was building in Montana for Denise and her two rotten kids. He didn't worry about the renovations on their house in Holmby Hills, even though the kitchen alone was costing $500K, and Denise kept changing the plans. Denise was a serial renovator. It was a disease. No, no, no. Barry Sindler worried about just one thing, the lease. He had one whole floor in an office building on Wilshire in Doheny, 23 attorneys in his office, none of them worth a shit, but seeing all of them at their desks impressed the clients, and they could do the minor stuff like take depositions and file delaying motions, stuff Barry didn't want to be bothered with. Barry knew that litigation was a war of attrition, especially in custody cases. The goal was to run the costs as high as you could and stretch the proceedings out as long as you could, because that way Barry earned the largest possible fees. And the spouse eventually got tired of the endless delays, the new filings, and, of course, the spiraling costs. Even the richest of them eventually got tired. By and large, husbands were sensible. They wanted to get on with their lives, buy a new house, move in with the new girlfriend, get a nice blowjob. They wanted custody issues settled. But the wives usually wanted revenge, so Barry kept things from being settled year after year until the husbands caved. Millionaires, billionaires, celebrity assholes, it didn't matter. They all caved in the end. People said it wasn't a good strategy for the kids. Well, screw the kids. If the clients cared anything about the kids, they wouldn't get divorced in the first place. They'd stay married and miserable, like everybody else, because the nerd had said something that jogged him back to attention. "I'm sorry," Barry Sindler said. "Run that by me again, Mr. Deal." "What did you just say?"
"I said, I want my wife tested."
"I can assure you, these proceedings will test her to the limit. And of course we'll put a detective on her, see how much she drinks, whether she does drugs, stays out all night, has lesbian affairs, all that, standard procedure."
"No, no," Deal said. "I want her tested genetically."
"For what?"
"For everything," he said.
"Ah," Barry said, nodding wisely. What the hell was this guy talking about? Genetic testing? In a custody case? He glanced down at the papers in front of him and the business card. "Richard Rick Deal, Ph.D. Barry frowned unhappily. Only assholes put a nickname on the card. The card said he was CEO of Biogen Research Incorporated, some company out in Westview Village.
"For example," Deal said, "I'll bet my wife has a genetic predisposition to bipolar illness. She certainly acts erratic. She might have the Alzheimer's gene. If she does, psychological tests could show early signs of Alzheimer's."
"Good. Very good." Barry Sindler was nodding vigorously now. This was making him happy. Fresh, new disputed areas. Sindler loved disputed areas. Administer the psychological test. Did the test show early Alzheimer's or not? Who the fuck could say for sure? Wonderful, wonderful. Whatever the test results, they would be disputed. More days in court, more expert witnesses to interview, battles of the doctorates dragging on for days. Days in court were especially lucrative. And best of all, Barry realized that this genetic testing could become standard procedure for all custody cases. Sindler was breaking new ground here. He'd get publicity for this. He leaned forward eagerly.
Go on, Mr. Deal.
Test her for the diabetes gene, breast cancer from the BRCA genes, and all the rest. And, Deal continued, my wife might also have the gene for Huntington's disease, which causes fatal nerve degeneration. Her grandfather had Huntington's, so it's in her family. Both her parents are still young, and the disease only shows up when you're older. So my wife could be carrying the gene, and that would mean a death sentence from Huntington's.
Yes, Barry Sindler said, nodding. That could render her unfit to be the primary caregiver to the children.
Exactly.
I'm surprised she hasn't been tested already.
She doesn't want to know, Deal said. There's a 50-50 chance she may have the gene. If she does, she'll eventually develop the disease and die, writhing in dementia. But she's 28. The disease might not appear for another 20 years. So if she knew about it now, it could ruin the rest of her life.
But it could also relieve her if she didn't have the gene.
Too big a risk. She won't test.
Any other tests you can think of?
Hell yes, Deal said. That's just the beginning. I want her tested with all the current panels. There are 1,200 gene tests now. 1,200? Sindler licked his lips at the prospect. Excellent! Why had he never heard of this before? He cleared his throat.
But you realize that if you do this, she will demand you be tested as well.
No problem, Deal said.
You've already been tested?
No. I just know how to fake the lab results. Barry Sindler sat back in his chair. Perfect. Beneath the high canopy of trees, the jungle floor was dark and silent. No breeze stirred the giant ferns at shoulder height. Hager wiped sweat from his forehead, glanced back at the others, and pushed on. The expedition moved deep into the jungles of central Sumatra. No one spoke, which was the way Hager liked it. The river was just ahead, a dugout canoe on the near bank, a rope stretched across the river at shoulder height. They crossed in two groups, Hager standing up in the dugout, pulling them across on the rope, then going back for the others. It was silent except for the cry of a distant hornbill. They continued on the opposite bank. The jungle trail grew narrower and muddy in spots. The team didn't like that. They made a lot of noise trying to scramble around the wet patches. Finally, one said, "How much farther is it?" It was that kid, the whiny American teenager with spots on his face. He was looking to his mother, a largish matron in a broad straw hat. "Are we almost there?" the kid whined. Hager put his finger to his lips. "Quiet." "My feet hurt." The other tourists were standing around, a cluster of bright-colored clothing, staring at the kid. "Look," Hager whispered, "if you make noise, you won't see them."
"I don't see them anyhow," the kid pouted.
But he fell into line as the group moved on. Today they were mostly Americans. Hager didn't like Americans, and they weren't the worst. The worst, he had to admit, were the...
"There! Look there!"
The tourists were pointing ahead, excited, chattering. About 50 yards up the trail and off to the right, a juvenile male orangutan stood upright in the branches that swayed gently with his weight. Magnificent creature, reddish fur, roughly 40 pounds, distinctive white streak in the fur above his ear. Hager had not seen him in weeks. Hager gestured for the others to be quiet and moved up the trail. The tourists were close behind him now, stumbling, banging into one another in their excitement. "Shh!" he hissed. "What's the big deal?" one said. "I thought this was a sanctuary." "Shh! But they're protected here." "Shh!" Hager needed it quiet. He reached into his shirt pocket and pressed the record button. He unclipped his lapel mic and held it in his hand. They were now about 30 yards from the orang. They passed a sign along the trail that said Bukut Alam Orangutan Sanctuary. This was where orphaned orangs were nursed to health and reintroduced into the wild. There was a veterinary facility, a research station, a team of researchers. "If it's a sanctuary, I don't understand why..." "George! You heard what he said. Be quiet." 20 yards now. "Look, another one. Two. There." They were pointing off to the left. High in the canopy, a 1-year-old crashing through branches with an older juvenile swinging gracefully. Hager didn't care. He was focused on the first animal. The white-streaked orang did not move away. Now he was hanging by one hand, swinging in the air, head cocked to one side as he looked at them. The younger animals in the canopy were gone. White-streaked stayed where he was and stared. 10 yards. Hager held his microphone out in front of him. The tourists were pulling out their cameras. The orang stared directly at Hager and made an odd sound, like a cough.
"Dvass!"
Hager repeated the sound back.
"Dvass."
The orang stared at him. The curved lips moved, a sequence of guttural grunts.
"Ustam dvass. Farlat lenmi."
One of the tourists said,
"Is he making those sounds?"
"Yes," Hager said.
"Is he talking?"
"Apes can't talk," another tourist said. "Orangs are silent. It says so in the book." Several snapped flash pictures at the hanging ape. The juvenile male showed no surprise, but the lips moved.
"Geen lichten dvass."
"Does he have a cold?"
a woman asked nervously.
"Sounds like he's coughing."
"He's not coughing,"
another voice said. Hager glanced over his shoulder. A heavyset man at the back, a man who had struggled to keep up, red-faced and puffing, now held a tape recorder in his hand, pointing it toward the orang. He had a determined look on his face. He said to Hager,
"Is this some kind of trick you play?"
"No," Hager said. The man pointed to the orang.
"That's Dutch," he said. "Sumatra used to be a Dutch colony. That's Dutch."
"I wouldn't know," Hager said.
"I would. The animal said, 'Stupid, leave me alone.' And then it said, 'No lights,' when the camera flashes went off."
"I don't know what those sounds were," Hager said.
"But you were recording them."
"Just out of curiosity."
"You had your microphone out long before the sounds began. You knew that animal would speak."
"Orangs can't speak," Hager said.
"That one can."
They all stared at the orangutan, still swinging from one arm. It scratched itself with the free arm. It was silent. The heavyset man said loudly,
"Geen lichten."
The ape just stared, blinked slowly.
"Geen lichten."
The orang gave no sign of comprehension. After a moment, it swung to a nearby branch and began to climb into the air, moving easily, arm on arm.
"Geen lichten."
The ape kept climbing. The woman in the big straw hat said,
"I think it was just coughing or something."
"Hey,"
the heavyset man yelled.
"Monsieur, comme ça va?"
The ape continued up through the branches, swinging in an easy rhythm with its long arms, It did not look down.
I thought maybe it speaks French, the man said.
He shrugged.
Guess not.
A light rain began to drip from the canopy. The other tourists put their cameras away. One shrugged on a light, transparent raincoat. Hager wiped the sweat from his forehead. Up ahead, three young orangs were scampering around a tray of papayas on the ground. The tourists turned their attention to them. From high in the canopy came a growling sound.
"Es wirst du kommen."
The phrase came to them clearly, surprisingly distinct in the still air. The heavy-set man spun around.
"What?"
Everyone turned to look upward.
"That was a swear word," the teenager said. "In French. I know it was a swear word. In French."
"Hush,"
his mother said. The group stared up at the canopy, searching the dense mass of dark leaves. They could not see the ape up there. The heavyset man yelled,
"Qu'est-ce que tu dis?"
There was no answer, just the crash of an animal moving through branches and the distant cry of a hornbill.
Cheeky chimp chews off tourists. News of the world.
Er verspricht im Dschungel Flöcke George Bush. Der Spiegel.
Orang parle français. Paris match beneath a picture of Jacques Derrida.
Muslim monkey berates Westerners. Weekly Standard.
Monkey mouths off. Witnesses agape. National Enquirer.
Talking chimpanzee reported in Java. New York Times. Subsequent correction printed.
Polyglot primate sighted in Sumatra. Los Angeles Times.
And finally, a group of tourists in Indonesia swear they were abused by an orangutan in the jungles of Borneo. According to the tourists, the ape swore at them in Dutch and French, which means it was probably a lot smarter than they were. But no recordings of the cursing chimp have turned up, leading us to conclude that if you believe this story, we have a job for you in the current administration. Plenty of talking apes there.
Countdown with Keith Olbermann, MSNBC News, no correction.
"Get this," Charlie Huggins said, looking at the television in the kitchen of his house in San Diego. The sound was turned off, but he was reading the crawl beneath. "It says talking ape sighted in Sumatra."
"Oh, you mean it got a speeding ticket?" his wife said, glancing at the screen. She was making breakfast.
"No," Huggins said. "They must mean the ape was sighted with an S."
"The ape was sighted, meaning the ape could see?"
His wife was a high school English teacher. She liked these jokes.
"No, honey. The story says some people in Sumatra encountered an ape in the jungle that talked."
"I thought apes can't talk," his wife said.
"Well, that's what the story says, so it has to be a lie."
"You think?"
"Oh, now, Britney Spears is not getting divorced. I'm relieved. She may be pregnant again. From the pictures, it looks like it. And Posh Spice wore a nice green dress to a gala. And Sting says he can have sex for 8 hours without stopping.
Scrambled or over easy," his wife said.
"Tantric, apparently."
"I mean your eggs.
Scrambled."
"Call the kids, will you?" she said. "Everything's almost ready."
"Okay."
Charlie got up from the table and headed for the stairs. When he got to the living room, the phone rang. It was the lab. In the laboratories of Radial Genomics, Inc., in the eucalyptus groves of the University of California at San Diego, Henry Kendall drummed his fingers on the countertop while he waited for Charlie to pick up. The phone rang three times. Where the fuck was he? Finally, Charlie's voice. Hello?
Charlie? Henry said. Did you hear the news?
What news?
The ape in Sumatra, for Christ's sake.
That has to be bullshit, Charlie said.
Why?
Come on, Henry. You know it's bullshit.
They said the ape spoke Dutch.
It's bullshit.
It might have been Utenbrock's team,
Kendall said. Nah, the ape was big, 2 or 3 years old.
So, Utenbrock could have done it a few years ago. His team's advanced enough. Besides, those guys from Utrecht are all liars.
Charlie Huggins sighed. It's illegal in the Netherlands to do that research.
Right, which is why they would go to Sumatra to do it.
Henry, the technology's much too difficult. We're years away from making a transgenic ape, you know that.
I don't know that. You hear what Utrecht announced yesterday? They harvested bull stem cells and cultured them in mouse testicles.
I would say that is difficult. I would say that is fucking cutting edge. Especially for the bulls.
I don't see anything funny here.
Can't you imagine the poor mice dragging around giant purple bulls' bowls?
Still not laughing.
Henry, Charlie said, are you telling me you see one report on television about a talking ape and you actually believe it?
I'm afraid I do.
Henry, Charlie sounded exasperated. It's television. This story's right up there with the two-headed snake. Pull yourself together.
The two-headed snake was real.
I have to get the kids to school. I'll talk to you later. And Charlie hung up.
Fucker. His wife always took the kids to school. He's avoiding me.
Henry Kendall walked around the lab, stared out the window, paced some more. He took a deep breath. Of course, he knew Charlie was right. It had to be a fake story.
But what if it wasn't?
It was true that Henry Kendall had a tendency to be high-strung. His hands sometimes shook when he spoke, especially when he was excited, and he was a bit of a klutz, always stumbling, banging into things at the lab. He had a nervous stomach. He was a worrier. But what Henry couldn't tell Charlie was that the real reason he was worried now had to do with a conversation that had taken place a week ago. It seemed meaningless at the time. Now it took on a more ominous quality. Some ditzy secretary from the National Institutes of Health had called the lab and asked for Dr. Kendall. When he answered the phone, she said,
"Are you Dr. Henry A. Kendall?"
"Yes."
"Is it correct that you came to the NIH on a 6-month sabbatical 4 years ago?"
"Yes, I did."
"Was that from May until October?"
"I think it was. What's this about?"
"And did you conduct part of your research at the primate facility in Maryland?"
"Yes."
"And is it correct that when you came to the NIH in May of that year, you underwent the usual testing for communicable diseases because you were going to do primate research?"
"Yes," Henry said. They had done a battery of tests, everything from HIV to hepatitis to flu. They'd drawn a lot of blood.
"May I ask what this is about?"
"I'm just filling out some additional paperwork," she said, "for Dr. Bellarmino." Henry felt a chill. Rob Bellarmino was the head of the genetics section of NIH. He hadn't been there 4 years before when Henry was there, but he was in charge of things now, and he was no particular friend of either Henry or Charlie.
"Is there some problem?" Henry asked. He had the distinct feeling there was.
"No, no," she said. "We've just misplaced some of our paperwork, and Dr. Bellarmino is a stickler about records. While you were at the primate facility, did you do any research involving a female chimpanzee named Mary? Her lab number was F402?
"You know, I don't remember," Henry said. "It's a long time back. I work with several chimps. I don't recall specifically." She was pregnant during that summer.
I'm sorry, I just don't remember.
That was the summer we had an outbreak of encephalitis, and they had to quarantine most of the chimps, is that right?
Yes, I remember the quarantine. They sent chimps all around the country to different facilities.
Thank you, Dr. Kendall. Oh, while I have you on the phone, can I verify your address? We have 348 Marbury Madison Drive, La Jolla?
Yes, it is.
Thanks for your time, Dr. Kendall.
That was the entire conversation. All Henry really thought at the time was that Bellarmino was a tricky son of a bitch. You never knew what he was up to. But now, with this primate in Sumatra, Henry shook his head. Charlie Huggins could argue all he wanted, but it was a fact that scientists had already made a transgenic monkey. They'd done it years ago. There were all kinds of transgenic mammals these days. Dogs, cats, everything. It was not out of the question that the talking orang was a transgenic animal. Henry's work at NIH had been concerned with the genetic basis of autism. He'd gone to the primate facility because he wanted to know which genes accounted for the differences in communication abilities between humans and apes. And he had done some work with chimp embryos. It didn't lead anywhere. In fact, he had hardly gotten started before the encephalitis outbreak halted his research. He ended up back at Bethesda and working in a lab for the duration of his sabbatical. That was all he knew. At least, all he knew for sure.
Humans and chimps interbred until recently. Species split did not end sex. Researchers find a controversial result from genetics. Researchers at Harvard and MIT have concluded that the split between humans and chimpanzees occurred more recently than previously thought. Gene investigators have long known that apes and human beings both derived from a common ancestor who walked the earth some 18 million years ago. Gibbons split off first 16 million years ago. Orangutans split about 12 million years ago. Gorillas split 10 million years ago. Chimpanzees and human beings were the last to split about 9 million years ago. However, after decoding the human genome in 2001, geneticists discovered that human beings and chimps differed in only 1.5% of their genes, about 500 genes in all. This was far fewer than expected. By 2003, scientists had begun to catalog precisely which genes differed between the species. It is now clear that many structural proteins, including hemoglobin and cytochrome C proteins, are identical in chimps and humans. Human and chimp blood are identical. If the species split 9 million years ago, why are they still so alike? Harvard geneticists believe humans and chimpanzees continued to interbreed long after the species split. Such interbreeding, or hybridization, puts evolutionary pressure on the X chromosome, causing it to change more rapidly than normal. The researchers found that the newest genes on the human genome appear on the X chromosome. From this, researchers argue that ancestral humans continued to breed with chimps until 5.4 million years ago, when the split became permanent. This new view stands in sharp contrast to the consensus view that once speciation occurs, hybridization is a negligible influence. But according to Dr. David Reich of Harvard, the fact that hybridization has rarely been seen in other species may simply be due to the fact that we have not been looking for it. The Harvard researchers caution that interbreeding of humans and chimpanzees is not possible in the present day. They point out that press reports of hybrid humanzees have invariably proven false.
Biogen Research, Inc. was housed in a titanium-skinned cube in an industrial park outside Westview Village in Southern California. Majestically situated above the traffic on the 101 freeway, The cube had been the idea of Biogen's president, Rick Diehl, who insisted on calling it a hexahedron. The cube looked impressive and high-tech while revealing absolutely nothing about what went on inside, which is exactly how Diehl wanted it.